Welcome, lucky listeners. Grab yourselves a hot cup of... Tuck yourself down deep into the covers and make sure the lights are on. It's time for Read Me a Nightmare.
Welcome to episode 5 of Read Me a Nightmare. I'm Angelique Fons, your host, and I'm very excited about today's episode. We have Grant Maverick, one of the best voices in the business, reading Invasive Species, which I believe is the best story I've ever written. Plus, we have an interview after the story with the editor-in-chief of Dreamforge, Scott Knoll. Scott is a world-class editor and one of the most approachable publishers I've met in my writing journey. He took my alien invasion story and transformed it into the tension-filled murder mystery with a surprising ending that you're about to hear. Grab your rain slicker, get some bug spray, and let's listen to Grant Maverick reading Invasive Species.
Invasive Species by Angelique Fons. A year ago, Brad Smudge rested a hand on his daughter's shoulder as they surveyed the rows of cannabis plants. The smell of ripe buds hung heavy in the greenhouse, and some of the green leaves were turning yellow. Moisture dripped off the glass, and sweat trickled down Cass's skin under her tank top. The old farmer took a deep breath. "Darling, that there's the smell of money. It smells like skunk. Would this stuff survive outside?" She raised her voice over the sound of rain pattering down on the glass roof. It was the end of August and thunderstormed almost every day. Very atypical weather for the Greater Toronto Area. "Mary Jane likes it warm with just a perfect bit of humidity. She doesn't like to get her knickers damp. This dang summer's been wetter than an otter's pocket." Cass strolled down the rows of plants, the heads on them dark and turning a reddish color. Her father followed with a notepad, taking a final count of his inventory. The greenhouse was the size of a large backyard pool, and it took a second mortgage on the farm to build it. It had been nearly invisible at the rear of the property until her dad had installed his LED grow lights. He put them in a couple weeks ago, complaining bitterly about the added cost and how the cussing clouds were stopping the sun from doing its damn job. The farm was very private, being surrounded by several hectares of crown land. But now Brad Smudge's grow-op could be seen glowing at night. He'd hooked up a gas generator to power the lights and was bringing in fuel by the gallons. If her mother was alive, she would have shut old Brad Smudge's pot emporium down in a New York minute. Arlene Smudge had been a ferocious Métis woman, and her French-Canadian spice, tempered with the farming wisdom from her indigenous heritage, kept the family firmly grounded. But now, there was no one to harness Brad's wild ideas, and he was making some risky decisions. "Didn't Carl from across the road come and tell you that it was dangerous to grow this stuff? Wasn't a grow-op a few concessions over robbed? Carl should mind his own damn business. Who takes advice from a guy trying to farm buffalo meat? Just because he drives around on that rusty Harley Davidson, he thinks he's some kind of criminal know-it-all. I hear buffalo is a great low-fat alternative, but, Dad, back to what you're trying to farm. Are you sure this is a legal grow? You're not great at paperwork." "I already have a buyer for it. The Alcohol and Gaming Commission, believe it or not. They're sending their inspector tomorrow, and then it's steak dinner for us." Her father was short and muscular with a slight beer belly. His thick black hair stuck out like a hockey player under his John Deere ball cap. Cass inherited his body shape, minus the stomach pot, with her own spectacular spill of long dark hair. Her light brown skin and sensible nature came from her mother. A sudden wave of love washed over her, watching him tend his crop. After Arlene died of cancer last year, they'd learned to depend on each other, becoming very close. Her mom had used hash oil in her tea for nausea relief near the end. "Look at these darn bugs," he said, pulling a shiny green beetle out of the soil. The bug crawled over his hand, trying to scuttle back to its dark spot, and Brad shuddered. "Dang gone it, got me a bad feeling about these things. Your ma was one for premonitions, but I think I'm having one." He tried to squash the bug between his two thick, calloused fingers, but it shot out of his hand unharmed and disappeared into the dirt. Can they ruin your sale? Cass asked. Not if I have anything to do with it. I'll scour each and every plant, even if it takes till sunrise. It's already getting past 7, Dad. You should get your rest. Nope, a farmer tends to his crop. Now throw your rain jacket on and head out. Cass stepped into the deluge and ran towards the house. The corn plants on the rest of their acreage wilted under the rain, the stalks small from too much moisture. They wouldn't even be able to harvest it this fall if the land didn't dry up. She hoped she'd get a good night's sleep. It was a big day for her tomorrow. She was starting her internship at a local media company in Toronto, part of her film college program. Steven Spielberg, move over. Cass banged through the screen door, peeling off her wet clothes and littering the hall. The decor of the farmhouse was simple and comfortable. She walked along the frayed carpet to the bathroom and drew herself a bath in the clawfoot tub. Pouring in some of her favorite bubble bath, she drifted off in the warm suds. Her eyes flew open when she heard what sounded like a gun. She sat up quickly in the bathwater, now cold. Who shot skeet at night? And hunting season wasn't for months. She threw on a bathrobe, grabbed her cell phone, and charged out the door in her rubber boots. The trail was muddy, the sky black with clouds, the rain a light drizzle. She stopped when she saw the headlights of several ATVs with tow-behind trailers parked outside the greenhouse. Piles of plants were tossed haphazardly in the dump carts. 4 dark forms moved among them. Her throat spasmed, and Cass threw up a hand to her mouth to stop from calling out. Tucking herself behind one of the larger trees, she pulled her cell phone out of her pocket. A tear slid down her face. She couldn't risk calling for help right now and draw attention to herself. She waited until she heard the ATVs driving off through the bush towards the Crownland. When she was sure they were gone, she dialed 911, slipping and scrambling through the mud to the greenhouse. Dad, are you okay? She wrenched open the door with slippery hands. Her dad was tied to a chair. Blood matting his thick, dark hair, where 2 bullets had torn through his head. Present day. The shiny green beetle crawled off the backpack and onto the wide white desk, multiple legs propelling it towards Cass's arm. Tentacles, twice the size of its inch-long body, gently probed her hand resting on the mouse. Her eyes teared as a vision of her father, though he was distorted and enormous, filled her mind. The image changed to a swarm of green bugs on a dune-filled landscape, scuttling over dead, bent trees. Cass blinked, feeling a tickle on her right hand. One of those horrid bugs was on her pinky finger. She remembered her father finding a beetle the day he died. His killers hadn't been caught, and she phoned the police once a week looking for updates. She hadn't had a good night's sleep since the murder, trying to figure out why someone would kill her father over some stupid plants. Now one had hitched its way in with her to work. She grabbed a Kleenex and tried to crush it. Even though she gave it a good thump, it scurried away into the shattery wires behind her monitor. She'd tell her boyfriend, an arborist specializing in invasive species, about the beetle later. Right now, she had a deadline to meet. Writing headlines for an agricultural website had to be done quickly to keep the click rate high. The more intriguing her line, the more people would click through to the full story, the more her company could charge advertisers. Killer tomato blight creates huge market shortages, Cass tapped on her keyboard. She tugged on a strand of her black hair hard enough to hurt and hit delete. Tomatoes die and farmers cry. Nope. Fries without ketchup? Say it isn't so. This line of copy would have to do. The full news article talked about local restaurants forced to adjust their menus with a restricted supply of tomatoes. Not exactly the film career she'd hoped for, but she was lucky to have this job. When she lost her dad, she got enough in life insurance to pay off the debt on the farm, but not enough to keep herself in college. Though devastated by his murder, she'd forced herself to drive to her internship the next day. And a good thing she did. When the marketing writer for the Farm News website went on maternity leave, Cass was in the right place at the right time. With global food insecurity becoming a thing, subscriber numbers were through the roof. Everyone wanted to know why grocery prices were so high. Most of her stories were about crop failures and infestations. The pictures were stomach-churning. Black fruit, vegetables covered with fuzz, lots of those weird green bugs crawling everywhere in gloomy, rainy weather. Heads sprout every 20 feet or so in the open concept plan at the office. It's the human equivalent of an industrial chicken farm. Big TV screens broadcast the different channels originating from the building. She'd love to move from website writing to TV production, one step closer to her film dreams. A news report on the TV closest to her was broadcasting about the unusual rainy weather. More than a year of above-average precipitation. The Toronto Islands were almost completely submerged, and everyone who lived there were evacuated to the mainland. The screen showed people canoeing down the bicycle pass with pets and carting bags of belongings. The show segued into a breaking news alert about crowds protesting the price of bread outside the Parliament buildings. Wheat crops suffered as much as corn this season. Her work was on the shores of Lake Ontario, directly across from the islands, and beside the Redpath Sugar Factory. She had a good view of it from her desk. It was a huge brick building with no windows and warehouse doors large enough for a transport truck. Water lapped at the concrete border, flooding the sidewalk with every wind surge. Sugar workers toiled diligently with sandbags to create a barrier. She finished up the last headline and then packed her bag to go. Living on a farm, more than an hour away from work, made for a long and painful commute. Cass cranked up the radio, letting hard rock assault her eardrums. But the loud music didn't stop visions of her dad with the green ball cap blown off his head, blood dripping down his thick arms. Why couldn't the police find the scum bastards who thought the addictive leaf was more valuable than her father's life? She gripped her steering wheel until her knuckles turned white. She couldn't let rage distract her from navigating the wet highway. Cass pulled into her driveway and looked out at the sky. Was it clearing? The old farmhouse looked sunken and small, like it was also grieving the loss of Brad and Arlene. Sun broke through the clouds, and she felt a bit of rare peace as the warm rays touched her cheek. She got out of her Subaru wagon and walked up the old wood steps through the front door. Navajo rugs added color to the small rooms and dated decor. Her mother had weaved them herself and were the most beautiful things in the house. A big black pickup truck with rust on the side rattled into the driveway. Cass leaned out the front door and shouted at the tall, skinny man who climbed out of the cab, "Let's have a picnic. I think it might actually be a clear evening." "Love of my life, anything for you," Devon said. "Just let me change." He gave Cass a kiss on her cheek and dropped his yellow work overalls by her backpack. She went into the kitchen to make a basket of bologna, processed cheese, and rice cakes. Pickings were slim at the grocery store. Devon lived with his parents up the road on a beef cattle farm. His day job was taking care of all the public park trees, keeping them trimmed and healthy. They'd been casually dating for a couple of years, but after Brad Smudge was murdered, he came by with flowers, beef pies, and a suitcase. "I was going to propose before living together, but no way I'm leaving you alone now. The ring can come later," he said. She went out to his truck and put a couple quilts in the cargo bed and then went back for the food. Devon, in jeans and a clean shirt, grabbed the picnic basket from her. "Did you call the cops again today?" he asked as they drove to the back of the field where the view was most spectacular. Cass's farm had a huge berm of cedar trees planted along the road for soil erosion. The barrier was also great for privacy. Devon had brought over some of his Angus cows to eat the corn left in the field. Almost no local farmer had bothered combining the rain-stunted silage. The black bees scattered as the four-wheel drive tore through the mud. "Yes, still nothing," she gestured to the bucking cattle. "I can't believe people are trying to steal your cows off your family farm. At least you can't see them from the road here. Plus, the standing corn isn't going to waste." Devon smiled at her and parked on the highest point on the land. Both of them hopped in the back of the pickup truck. The view was spectacular. Pine trees and farm fields rolling as far as the eyes could see. Cass reached into her wicker picnic basket and passed her boyfriend a beer. "I found one of those green bugs in my backpack. Are they still spreading in the region?" "Well, I saw some oak trees that didn't look so good. Trees are dying faster than we can plant them." Cass took a sip of her drink. "And no one can identify them yet?" I bagged one of the buggers to send off to Pest Control Canada, but I figure it's a new invasive species. Just what we need, another evil breed of bug, Cass took a cheese slice from the basket. They ate and laid back on the blankets in companionable silence as the sky got darker. A few light trails shot across the sky. Did you see that? Was there supposed to be a meteor shower tonight? Devon sat up quickly. Looks like it landed in the next field, Cass said. Well, we don't want to be conked on the head by a rock, Devon joked. Let's head back. Cass noticed a glow coming from the other side of the field. Why are the grow lights on in the greenhouse? I told you to stay out of there. I'm getting tired of eating rice cakes, babe. Your dad's greenhouse is enormous. We could feed a family of eight for a year. Devon's face reddened as his voice rose. I'd rather starve. It's full of bad memories. She clenched her fists. Look, I want to test a theory. I've noticed that when I add more LED lights, the bugs scatter. I'm planting fruit and vegetables, kale, cucumbers, tomatoes, beans, and strawberries. I swore I would never go back in there, she softened a little. She went to bed hungry every night, her favorite jeans swimming on her. Cass's mouth salivated at the idea of fresh strawberries. The produce section was bare at the market. Arlene had taught her to make some amazing strawberry pies, and she could sell them at the roadside or give them away to hungry families. Whatever, do what you need to do, she muttered as they drove back up to the house. She didn't wake Devon in the morning, quickly getting dressed and heading out the door. Normally, she gave him a kiss, but he had kept her up till midnight talking about his plans for the cursed greenhouse. She kept seeing her father's bloody body murdered for a plant. She plotted revenge instead of sleeping. In the morning, she could swear she saw even more bugs than usual inching along the battered corn stalks, but it was hard to tell in the dim early morning light. Cass drove exhausted to the city with waves of rain beating against the windshield. Last night's clear skies seemed a dream. The slicing of the wipers was so loud she couldn't even hear her rock music. The highway ditch was littered with hydroplane cars, but she managed to get to work safely before the real rush hour. Arriving early worked in Cass's favor to find a premium outdoor parking spot. The underground parking lot was flooded. She turned on her computer, and the first story she had to write was depressing. Farmers committing suicide at an alarming rate. The piece explained crop failure, low yields, and financial troubles were to blame. Cass tapped out quickly, "Why are our farmers dying?" Short and dramatic, good for click-through. Some of her co-workers had been laid off as the economy slid into a depression, but the farm website was growing in popularity. The public was trying to understand why they couldn't buy fresh vegetables and food banks were running out of food. She looked out her window at the new sign posted on the flooded loading dock of the sugar factory. Red Path is closed until further notice due to high water levels. Cass noticed another green bug crawling on her desk. Instead of trying to smush it, she let it crawl onto her palm. A vision of her father tied to a chair, a man pointing a gun at him. She recognized the mutton chops and scarred face. Her neighbor, Carl. She watched, horrified, as he fired. Her vision washed out in a sea of red. Gasping, she dropped the bug and charged out of the building. The drive home, a blur as she kept seeing Carl shooting her father, both men giants, the blood splashing onto the leaf she's watching from. Pulling into her driveway, the downpour exhausted itself into a persistent drizzle. She didn't notice the black pickup truck in the driveway. Devon intercepted her mad dash down the hallway with tractor keys in hand. "What are you doing home?" she asked. "My hours have been cut back, so I'm working in the greenhouse." She yanked the keys out of his hands. "We have to go over to Carl's right now. I think he murdered Dad." "Slow down. Why would an old wannabe biker kill Brad Smudge?" "Just come." Devon and Cass crossed the country concession from the far edge of their land to pass on to Carl's land surreptitiously. He had a few buffalo grazing his hayfield with chain-link fencing and signs posted every few feet. "Danger, keep out, buffalo pasture." They clambered over the fence and dropped onto the grass. "Shh," Devon said, gesturing to the bull sleeping in the grass several feet away. His heavy head rested on the ground while his long, damp fur stuck to the sides of his enormous torso. Long, tapered horns framed the wide head. They walked quickly by him, the creatures not even stirring. Two other buffalo, smaller than the bull, were at the back of the paddock, heads down, nipping at alfalfa. What kind of buffalo business survives with a herd of three? Cass asked. A front organization, that's what kind, Devon said, his tall frame hunched as he ran along the edge of the fencing. At the back of Carl's property, there was a small stable and riding area. It had seen better days, the paint peeling off the barn board. Trees surrounded the building, old oak and walnut half dead, and a back driveway accessed the cavernous riding area. A few Harley Davidsons, in far better shape than Carl's, were parked near the roll-up door. Maybe Carl isn't such a wannabe after all. Devon crept up to an oil-streaked window. Cass followed him and they peered into the arena. There were rows and rows of green plants hanging upside down in the ring. Wire was strung from one end of the 70-foot by 130-foot space to the other. A couple of rough-looking men in leather jackets with some sort of patch on them were sitting in lawn chairs in the corner. "Can you read the patch?" Cass asked, her face flushing with anger. "They must have killed my dad for his pot. They aren't growing it, just drawing and selling it. We don't need to know which biker gang did this. Let's get out of here and call the cops." Devon put a hand on Cass's back and hustled her through the buffalo paddock. "Devon, I think one of those strange bugs telepathically showed me Dad getting shot." Tears gathered in her eyes and there was a strange sensation in her stomach. She didn't know if it was relief, anger, or nausea. "Really? Maybe those bugs could be useful after all." He ran faster. The large bull was awake and grazing when they scuttled by, but he ignored them. Jumping up onto the fence, the both of them clambered over, ran across the road, and flew into the farmhouse. Cass pulled her cell phone out of her pocket. She called 911 and reported the illegal operation across the road and her suspicions about the death of her father. She didn't mention telepathic bugs. Devon went out into the struggling cornfield and came back 15 minutes later with two of the beetles in a mason jar. They both cupped one of their hands. The little legs tickled Cass's hand as she felt the creature exploring her palm. No panic or attempt to escape. The same vision of a dune-filled landscape with dead bent trees. She held the bug longer this time. Two moons were in the sky and a strange rock formations could be seen in the distance. She opened her eyes and looked at Devon, sliding the bug back into the jar. "What did you see?" she asked. Devon also placed his bug back and closed the lid. The two green creatures roamed around the bottom of it, tentacles exploring the glass. "I think I saw the prairies, but all the crops were gone, just dirt and bugs everywhere. I saw something similar, but I don't think it was on Earth. It was like a planet that had been completely devoured by bugs." They stared at each other as sirens in the distance grew closer. 6 months later, Cass flicked on the news to get an update of the state of the world. Global flooding is the worst it has ever been. The constant rain has helped the Yama bug, as scientists have dubbed it, decimate our crops. She clicked to another channel. India is in crisis and the people are rioting. Famine is a reality, click. Food insecurity in the United States has led to civil unrest in the streets, click. The Yama bug, coined after the Hindu god of death, and we don't know where the species originated from. Pesticides don't kill them. She turned off the television and turned to Devon. "Is this how we go? Humanity gets taken out by the bug age?" Cass asked. She looked out the window where a green beetle probed the glass with long tentacles. It looked perfectly content bathing in the sheets of rain lashing the house. Devon hiked around the property every morning and had some favorite bugs he visited. He would give them a quick touch to see if anyone was casing their farm. It took practice, but the both of them were learning how to tap into the beetle's telepathy. He had been laid off completely from his arborist job, but Devon was still writing her headlines and even articles now from home. As long as the power was still on, people wanted to keep tabs on agricultural news. "If we can learn to work with the bugs, maybe the rest of the world can," Devon pulled on his raincoat. Cass slipped into galoshes and followed him out the door. The two of them walked to the back of the property where her father's greenhouse sat, glowing with the extra-generated powered lights. There was a river at the back of the property, and her boyfriend had figured out how to tap the water's energy to run his generator. She followed Devon in through the door and breathed deeply. The smell of fresh tomatoes, cucumbers, and strawberries filled her lungs. She could finally handle being in the place her dad died. The bikers were convicted of drug trafficking, and Carl jailed for the murder of Brad Smudge. Carl had been the president of Satan Sinners, a small local biker gang, and the police found many weapons hidden in his barn, including the murder weapon. Carl's oily fingerprints all over the rifle that killed her father. The bug's vision had been bang on. She took out her iPhone and filmed Devon working on his plants and replacing LED bulbs. They had started up their own farming YouTube channel called Survive the Yama. They were teaching families how to grow enough food in small greenhouses to last them at least a year. So far, having enough light seemed the best way to fight the beetles. They didn't like the sun, bright light, or LED grow bulbs. Scientists were working around the clock, figuring out how to disperse the cloud cover and let sunlight bathe the planet again. So many people were watching Cass and Devon's videos, they sometimes crashed the site. When she got enough footage, she pressed her nose up against the glass to look outside. She was finally a filmmaker, and silently thanked Brad Smudge for his greenhouse. It was their only hope for survival until they could figure out how to either stop the Yama beetle or coexist with them. So far, they had proven to be wonderful sentries. The world needed better communication. Perhaps telepathy was the answer. She shuddered, thinking about the dreadful dead landscapes and her early visions from the bugs. In the darkening evening, she saw the bright glow of another meteor catapulting to Earth. It tore a beautiful line of light through the cloudy sky. What she didn't see were the thousands of green bugs nestled within the silicon, iron, and nickel of the space rocks.
I hope you enjoyed Grant Maverick's reading of Invasive Species. Now, let's get to my chat with Scott Knoll, editor-in-chief of Dreamforge Anvil, the publication that purchased Invasive Species for issue number one, Let's Talk Story. If you enjoy reading science fiction and fantasy, or you're a writer yourself, you don't want to miss this interview. Let's dive right in. If you have any questions or want to learn more after listening, please check out the show notes at www.fonz.ca/works/podcast. Hi, I'm Angelique Fonz, and I'm here talking with Scott Knoll from Dreamforge Anvil.
Good morning, Angelique, and thanks for having me.
So, I am very excited about how your new magazine initiative picked up Invasive Species.
Well, one of the things is, just really quick, what is Dreamforge Anvil? Well, since 2019, we were publishing, my wife and I, publishing Dreamforge Magazine, and that was a full-print, fully illustrated magazine, and as many businesses did, we ran afoul of the COVID year. So, the resources that we had to be able to print and publish and distribute, that magazine basically just faded away during that year. So we had to decide what we were going to do. And we decided basically to focus a little more on working with writers to improve stories. And that became Dreamforge Anvil. So we're not doing print now. We're mostly online. We actually are going to do some print on Kindle print on demand, which we can talk about later. But we basically were changing our focus. And in changing our focus, we decided to become Dreamforge Anvil. And one of the things we wanted to be able to do was work with authors to show other authors how, you know, stories evolve and how you get from an initial manuscript to the final published story, that sort of thing. And just enter kind of that world and use the things we had learned over the last 2 years in reading a few thousand stories to kind of help authors. Now, one of the things I liked about, and let's talk about Invasive Species. One of the things I liked about Invasive Species was in your typical horror story where Earth is you know, being invaded or something bad is happening or it's an apocalypse, everything focuses on that terrible thing and how people are running around scrambling to survive it. What I liked specifically about Invasive Species was you start with sort of the ordinary lives of the people and what it is that they're trying to accomplish as just living human beings in the world sort of thing. And then you slowly bring in the essentially the horror element of the invasive species that is coming and is going to basically, you know, possibly devastate Earth and change Earth. But the characters are still involved in essentially finding justice, you know, for a family member. I don't want to, you know, do spoiler stuff here. But,
oh, it's at the end of the story. Spoil away. The interview comes after.
All right. Okay. So you see that the invasive species is not only becoming invasive to Earth, but it's becoming invasive to their lives, right? It's right. Like they're they're having ordinary lives. They're trying to get justice, for the murder that's happened in their family. And that continues through the story. They never lose track of that. And do find a way to bring justice. And by the end of the story, you see the invasive species potentially getting worse. But at the end, where you have the typical horror element, oh, more bugs are coming, the meteorites are coming, and that sort of thing. You really also have a feeling that they will weather that. And one of the things in my mind, was this very much parallels what we've just gone through with COVID. I would say it's like, yes, there was significant devastation. Lots of people, lost family members. We know some people who lost family members to COVID, and it's been very tragic and that sort of thing. But a lot of people soldiered on and basically moved into the next thing in their lives, just as, we found a way to move on with, Dreamforge, even though we didn't have quite the resource we had before. We wanted to do something good, and we found a way to continue on. And the old saying, make lemonade out of when the world hands you lemons. So that's what I liked specifically about invasive species.
I do have to throw in here, invasive species was not that strong a story when it got to you. I think you added a lot of that continuity throughout it. I thought that's what I found so wonderful and frankly, just mind-blowingly eye-opening about your comments and how you helped me with that story. Because as I told you, that's the first story I ever wrote. And I revised it and revised it and revised it. And I think I wrote it in, 2017, 2018? And it didn't make it to print till, 2021? So I have to thank you for that and how you managed to pick out what was good and then help guide me.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's very nice to hear. And that is kind of what we wanted to do with Dreamforge Anvil. And then also to, show people, a little bit about how that process works with the feature that we have with line edits and that sort of thing for our subscribers. But that comes out of when my wife and I really didn't have any publishing experience up until we started Dreamforge. But when we started Dreamforge, we then had the experience of reading like about 2,000 stories,
right?
which we've been readers. We've been readers all of our lives, but we haven't been reading basically submissions and people trying to, break into getting their stories published, and people who are in the beginning to intermediate level, getting published. And that was an eye-opening experience. And we worked with a team of first-line readers that we recruited, which amazingly from all over the world. We have first-line readers from, Germany and, Africa and Australia and all these different countries around the world. And all together, we basically learned, oh, there are very common things that these people are doing that make these stories not as good as they could be. And probably nobody's told them.
Well, because nobody told me. In fact, I was just lucky my story worked for you. This is where your seminars are also. What an amazing resource. Very helpful. The last one was really very good. I loved your, what was the very first seminar that we did?
Let's see. We did plotting as problem solving. We did art as story, and we did Wolf Moon's one on nailing the opening. Are some that I remember. And then we did some in March that
The March one was about opening crafting, how to craft nail. It wasn't nail your opening, but it was very helpful on how to structure a story, right? The three
story structure, yep.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was very, I think my stories have gotten better since then. Actually, what I've done is went and rewrote all my other stories that I thought were good using the points that I learned from your seminar and Wolfman's seminar.
Great. I'm really glad to hear that, because that's what we're focusing on this year. And we are, like I said, in addition to simply publishing stories, you brought out a good point, is we've done some webinars, which were experimental for us. We've never done that before either. But part of the joy of life is jumping into things and doing new things and seeing where you can help and whether you can be a success at it or not. So we've done webinars now that have helped look at specific points in story structure, whether they're the beginning or whether it's, It's, you know, how to break the hook and get people, you know, and we'll continue to do things like that. We're also now doing, just starting our first meeting will be on June 27th. We're doing a group called Dreamcasters, which will be a small group of people who support us on Patreon. And we'll be just having discussions. Think of it a little bit, you know, the easy analogy would be, think of it almost like a little book club. But one of the things we're going to do is also bring in guest authors and publishers. Our first guest will be Angela Rico Smith from Space and Time magazine. And she's going to be talking about press releases. She's going to be talking about the importance as an author of doing press releases and how you do them and how you get them out there. And we're already starting to be able to line up some authors from Bruce McAllister, who is a very experienced short story author and novelist. And he has a poem in our latest issue of Dreamforge Anvil, which just came out a day or so ago. And we're also going to be having Paul Dellinger, who is a science fiction author from the 1960s. He's had lots of short story experience. And we're just continuing that lineup because we're finding that a lot of the friends and acquaintances we've made over the last few years are perfectly willing to come in and help us, you know, by talking to writers and just talking about the craft and that sort of thing. So it'll be a little discussion group.
And I need to get in on that. So
yeah. Okay. Well, how you do that is go to Patreon, Dreamforge, I think it's Dreamforge Magazine, patreon.com/ Dreamforge Press.
I'll put it in the show notes. I'll put this in the show notes.
And what we're doing is the $3 a month level and above, you can become part of Dreamcasters. And one of the things I like to say, both for Dreamcasters and really for subscriptions and any funds that come our way from what we're doing, that goes directly to paying for stories. That goes directly to creatives who are writing the stories and some for illustration. But as far as Dreamforge is concerned, my wife and I pay all the other bills. So we pay for the website and the readers portal and layout and all that kind of stuff. So one of the nice things, if you contribute to us, you can know is you're really just passing your money on to another creative individual that we're going to try to get their story out there for people to read.
Which is great. This is something that I found interesting. I sort of felt when I was participating in your webinars, almost that I found my clan. Like, you know, you sit alone at your computer, you do your typing. It's a very almost lonely sort of endeavor. And I often feel like I'm, you know, a voice screaming in a sea and nobody can hear me. And I don't even know all the other voices screaming around me, where it was really interesting to sit and listen to other authors who are sort of experiencing the same things I'm experiencing.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's one of the things that I realized as we've been going through this process. And in Dreamforge Anvil issue 3, which just came out online on Sunday, I have an article there that I wrote that's called Writing as a Martial Art. It's really an analogy, but it speaks to what you just said. And that's the idea that by sitting alone and simply trying to perfect your craft on your own, that can be a little, it's hard to tell where you're at in the process. You don't have anything to gauge it against. And how that analogy works in martial arts, if you want to train physically and learn a martial art, you're in a dojang, you're with a group of people, other, you know, people of your same skill level, and you're all working together and matching your skills together. And it becomes very easy to rapidly grow. And it also becomes very easy to know where you stand, you know, in that group. And when you're writing all by yourself, you don't know any of those things. You really could pick up very easy points just by turning to the person next to you and asking a question or asking for advice, but they're not there. And so that's what that article is about. It's basically how do we, make the writing experience a little bit more like what you're saying you'd love, which is basically just talking to people and understanding and getting some feedback and understanding why this particular thing does or doesn't work.
A lot of people in your webinars were first readers for other magazines, and it was their comments in the informal chats afterwards where they talked about sort of what they look for as first readers and sort of, and what they write and how they are finding places to be published. I thought that was just eye-opening. It's funny. I never sat and thought about who is the actual person reading the story. For some reason, I always just thought it was the editors. I never even thought of this this cadre, this line of the first line of defense, right? The first reader who you have to get past before you get to the editor.
Well, yes. And it works different ways in different magazines. So I've heard a number of people say different things. In some magazines, they actually are a filter and some stories get to the editor to read. The way we run it is basically that they act as advisors and are giving feedback, but I actually see all the stories.
Oh, so you work twice as hard then.
Well, the thing is, you have to realize it's, I don't say I read all the stories, because remember, in any particular reading period, we may have 500, you know, to 1,000 stories come in, and I have a full-time job. we run a business beside Dreamforge. So it does become very, very challenging. But the way it works is our first line readers will basically, we have a starring system, 1 through 5. Now, 1 through 5 doesn't necessarily mean awful to great. What it means is how appropriate is it for Dreamforge? Because you really have to understand what market that you're selling to. And someone could send in essentially a very good horror story and get a 1 star, because the first line reader would just be saying, this is not Dreamforge.
Or, yeah.
In addition to that, they basically leave some comments, and over, you know, we've been doing this for a couple of years now, 3 years now. So they have learned to be very succinct in what they're saying, and they're telling me why they don't think this story will work. Oftentimes they'll basically be saying, well, there's a lot of exposition for 5 pages and we really haven't got a hook yet. So, you know, they're basically talking structure, and that's one of the things that has led us into this idea of trying to help writers with understanding some of the structure points, because we will commonly see things that, you know, stories that simply start out with lots of fast-paced action, but we really don't even know anything about the characters or what world's going on, or, you know, that sort of thing. And those are the comments that come back. They'll tell me what they feel is structurally wrong with the story or why it's inappropriate for Dreamforge. So my job now isn't to spend all of my time reading through all of the stories, but I do want to, and other editors don't do it this way, but I tend to take a look at what my first line readers have said. Then I look at the story and I start scanning down through to basically prove to myself that that's a good analysis.
Oh, interesting.
And right. If I can see in a few minutes that analysis is correct, then that story, you know, I'm going to potentially return. Now, that story may be well written, like the actual language, use of language and development of scene and dialogue may be very well done, or it may not be. But there's going to be some point that, you know, we're basically rejecting the story, and I don't like to use rejection. I often say return the story. We're returning the story based on the fact that it's not fitting what we're doing in some way. And that could be the structural elements. It just doesn't flow in the way that we would want it to flow. It could be that, you know, it's a Mars story and we just published 5 of them. It could be that we got, you know, we are buying a time travel story this for this issue, but I got 17 of them and, you know, 3 of them were really great. Yours was one of the really great ones, but I'm only publishing 1. So there are many reasons why stories get returned that do not speak directly to their quality. Sometimes it does, but we're, you know, trying to build an experience, an issue, which means we need some short things. We need some fantasy. We need some science fiction. We need some things that are a little bright and hopeful, and we'll take some things that are a little darker, but with a hopeful ending. So we're trying to kind of build a little bit of an experience in terms of an issue. And that's why most of the time, you know, your story's going to get returned, because you don't know what's going on in the head of the editor or what their experiences are. And you just have to, if you've built a really good story, you just have to keep it out there in circulation. You have to see who has the market that, and what are they doing now, and try to make your best guesses. I think this would be a good fit over here. But you are kind of wasting your time if you don't do any market research at all, or if you send it to a place where you absolutely know it can't be accepted. I've had people send me essentially movie scripts.
Oh,
it's like I don't produce movies. It's like,
oh, you have movie scripts.
Why did you do that? I've had people say, here, do you want to read my novel? It's like, well, no, because I'm not in a position to publish novels right now, you know. So understanding even on the basics, what the market is you're sending to, what word length are they looking for this time? Have they said anything about particular themes that they want? Have you read anything? You know, lots of things are available free online, at least as samples for lots of publications. So have you even seen whether or not what you're doing kind of matches that?
It's so important. I must say one thing, I just found your market rant, right? I found it looking up lists of science fiction and fantasy magazines to submit to. Saw that you were into hopeful fiction, which is sort of the same genre. I don't like the bleak stories either. But what I loved is you kept sending me a little bit of feedback, which then helped me restructure my stories, or it made me feel better that somebody, once again, the voice, you know, screaming in the sea and nobody's listening. I knew that you guys were listening. So it made me.
Well, I wish we could do that for everyone. So do count yourself with a little lucky star, but because when you receive 2000 manuscripts or 500 manuscripts in a 2 week period or whatever, you can't give feedback to everyone. It's just not possible. It's just not possible to do that. So one of the things that we're trying to do here with Dreamforge Anvil is with the webinars, with the discussion groups, that sort of thing, is to be able to get more information out there that would be general information that would be available for everyone. Because if we did give feedback to everyone, a lot of it would be exactly the same feedback. A lot of it would be, you know, exactly how the story was opened incorrectly and they didn't use a hook properly. A lot of it would be about how they used way too much exposition and they placed it incorrectly in the story. A lot of it would be how they didn't build tension to a climax. It would be the same story structural things. And one of the things in doing Dreamforge Anvil, I looked around and I said, well, there are lots of writing courses out there. And there are lots of people who are mentoring science fiction writers. And there's lots of stuff out there. But I'm still seeing 2000 manuscripts that need help. So I said, there must be a little corner that we can help in, you know, So people, I'm glad you found us and you feel that we're your clan. I think everybody should do that on some level. It's like, look around. There are people out there trying to help. We're not the only one. If you like what we're doing in our approach, we certainly appreciate your support. But that seems to me to be what lots of writers are not doing, at least as far as I can see from the manuscripts that come in. It's they need that feedback. They need some level of instruction on just here are some basic things to look for. And that's what we hope to do. Now, as far as feedback for everyone, what we're doing is basically for most of the time now with Dreamforge Anvil, we're simply sending the stories back. But what we're going to try to do is pick some from each reading period and send them more detailed feedback. Because one of the things that even when we could send feedback in the past, it was always a little snippet, and the little snippets can be misleading. And, you know, it's like, right. if I do have 5 minutes to tell you that there was too much exposition in the first two pages, you may not know what that means, or you may not know how it relates to the story or to your writing in general. So we're trying to, over the course of time, pick out some and say to these people, you know, I'd like to give you some detailed feedback on your story. Do you even want to hear it? Because one of the things, some people don't want that feedback. It's disconcerting to them.
They take it too personally.
Take it too personally. And, if we find someone, it's like, yes, I'd like to have some feedback on this. We'll give it to them. And we're trying to do that. When we do that, we're trying to do it a little bit randomly. So some people who are close but just need a little guidance are going to get it. And some people who may, you know, really not have the really even need help with their English and their sentence structure and that sort of thing, you know, I'm sure we'll hit one of those too, because we don't want to just concentrate on the people who are getting there. We want to spread it out a little more randomly and also just talk to some people who are very beginning and having a lot of trouble and try to give them some guidance as well.
Right, 'cause it takes a lot of time. No, that's fantastic. So you're a writer yourself.
Yes, actually, that's how I've made my living. Now, I never had a career in science fiction and fantasy writing, but when I went to college, I graduated as an English major, and ever since my very first job out of school, I've always been writing something, whether it's brochures for tourism or whether it's that sort of thing, advertising. I got my third career. I think I went from tourism to transportation to computer games, which was really cool. The computer games stuff happened when I won Writers of the Future back in 1990. So that was way back in like volume 7, and they're in the volume 30s now. Or I think I was in volume 7 or 6, but in any case, they're in the 30s now.
Beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. That got me noticed locally by a computer game company that was starting up called Event Horizon at that point. And eventually it was called Dreamforge. So now you see the connection.
Oh, it all makes sense.
So yeah. So I started working as a writer with a computer company, gaming company called Dreamforge. We made a number of Ravenloft style games and games for Disney
Neat career. That must have been fun.
That was a lot of fun. It was also a very exciting time because it was a time when a few people could get together and start a small company, and then that company could grow. So the company that I started with initially had three partners who started the company. And by the time the company basically passed into history, it had like 60 employees.
Wow.
And that was a whole transitionary period when large publishers were buying up companies and little companies were fading away and that sort of thing. But yes, very exciting because, you know, you start out as a writer writing game manuals and novellas and that sort of thing for the games. And then they basically turn to you and say, well, you wrote this stuff. Do you think you could direct the voice actors? And it's like, yeah, I guess so. I'll go do that. And then you direct the voice actors. And then they turn to you and say, well, you know, you're handling your stuff and you're directing those people okay. Looks like you could be a manager. Do you want to be an associate producer is what they call it. It's sure, I'll be an associate producer. It's like, okay, so go associate produce this game, make it happen. And you get to do that. And then basically it's like, can you handle doing two games at once? And it's like, sure, why not? And you do that. And it's like, well, you did that very well. Do you want to be a project manager, you know, and just be in charge of multi-million dollar games kind of thing? And then it's like, oh, why not? You know, and what was happening at the company that we were working with, both my wife and I were actually at the company at the same time and coming up those lines from different angles. So I came through writing. She started as a line artist and then an art lead and then an art director and then a project manager. And by the time we were both on the same level, that's kind of when we were really working together and you know, we fell in love and got married and you know, we've been together like for 23 years now, working 24 hours a day with each other every day in one way or another.
You must really like each other.
And we get along very well. We're a very good team. And you know, so that was an experience there where I, you know, wrote a lot for, you know, game interaction text and that sort of thing. And by the time I was a project manager, though, we had other writers that, you know, were basically doing the work and just were, you know, reporting to me and that kind of thing. And some of them were very brilliant and have gone on to, you know, write other things, including movies and that sort of thing. So they've done very well. And from there, toward the end, that's a very stressful career, by the way. But toward the end of that career, my wife decided to leave and start her own business. And a year or so later, she pulled me into it as well. And that's become what today is called Chroma Studios, which is our web and marketing and software development business, which helps essentially pay for us doing fun things like right. Dreamforge, which we named in honor of the old company that we used to work with.
What sort of clients do you work with your company?
Oh, all over the country. We work with industrial clients, commercial clients. Like, just to give you an example, one of our clients would be a manufacturer of vaults for banks and security systems and stuff. One of our customers would be a fabricator of HVAC, the stuff, ductwork that goes into buildings when they're making buildings. But we'd also be working, for instance, with a local chiropractor on their website, or we'd be working with an electrical, just person who comes to your house and fixes your electrical box. So all the way from very just one person entrepreneurial stuff to large companies that, you know, do home remodeling or whatever, all across the spectrum. And we service them with both creating website solutions and oftentimes business workflow software to, you know, help them get things done.
So this is why your website is so entirely gorgeous.
Well, yes, the Dreamforge website, well, One of our partners, young woman named Chrissy, who's actually our partner, and eventually when we retire, you know, it'll Chroma Studios will be her business. She's extremely talented. So the only thing I had to do to get her to do the Dreamforge website for us was say, you can do whatever you want. And to her, that means I get to win an award. So because if she gets to do whatever she wants, she usually is able to submit it and win an award somewhere, which she did. The Dreamforge website won what's called a Davy Award for, you know, creative, you know, style and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, so that's all we had to do. So you can do whatever you want, go win an award. And yeah, she was nice enough to make our website for us.
That's amazing. Well, I certainly hope any listeners will come and check out your website and become part of the clan if they're writers like me. Because like I said, I'm so happy I found you guys. It's like my eyes went from shut to open.
I'm really delighted to hear that, because that's the most we could have hoped for, was to hear that kind of feedback from what we're trying to do.
Right. Well, I'm going to keep on. I mean, even it's funny. What I found interesting too, I guess we're running out of time, so I better not delve too into it, but it's interesting the Writers of the Future connection going on too. There's quite a few writers in your little group who are submitting, writing for. Wolf Moon is another winner.
Yes. Well, and again, one of the things we've seen with Dreamforge is we've published a number of Writers of the Future winners, and that's often been in, like, we don't do it always, but we will read blind as well, depending on the reading period. And so we don't know that we're not giving special treatment to a Writers of the Future writer. We're simply selecting a story and often later seeing, oh, they were a Writers of the Future writer. Because I think Writers of the Future itself is a venue that basically finds writers who are just on that edge of ready to go professional and brings them into that fold and gives them publicity and helps them get noticed. But you'll often see when Writers of the Future does make a choice and publishes someone that they have found someone who has those skills that are going to get noticed by other people as well.
It's interesting. Well, just randomly, Invasive Species was picked as a runner-up for Writers of the Future before you picked it up. So it's interesting how everything's connected. I love that. Anyway, Scott, I guess we should probably wrap this up, but I love this chat, and this has been great.
It's been very nice talking to you, yes.
You're certainly going to see me in more of your webinars, trust me. I'm going to immediately go join Patreon and...
Oh, well, thank you. Okay.
Right? And I've been very happy with the webinars I had before. Like I said, I think my work has actually gotten much better.
Good. We'll be glad to work with you and keep you on that path.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you once again for your time. And yes, everybody go check out Dreamforge Anvil.
Thank you for listening and hanging in till the very end. Once again, if you want to learn more about Scott Nolan and Dreamforge, the story behind the story of Invasive Species, or our exceptional voice actor Grant Maverick, you can find the show notes at www.fonz.ca and click on the podcast page. Until next time, sleep well until the next episode of Read Me a Nightmare.